Okay. Good morning. Right, I'm going to continue today by talking about the future. That's what I was talking about last time, isn't it? Now, the future has a name in systematic theology. I wonder how many of you know what the name is that's given in systematic theology for the future, the last or the end things. It's actually called eschatology. Can you put it up on the board, please, Chris? Called eschatology. Now, why is it called eschatology? Well, eschatos is the Greek word. Remember, the New Testament was written in Koine Greek, probably the most spoken language at the time of Jesus. And eschatos means last or end things. And ology is what we call a suffix. Now, you probably know what a prefix is. Last time I talked about a prefix, didn't I? The Latin prefect tri, which meant free. Now, a prefix is at the start of a word. A suffix comes at the end of the word. And the most famous English suffix is ing, beginning, running, throwing, so on. But another one is ology. Ology is a Greek suffix. And it means word, because it comes from the Greek word logos. There are two Greek words that are very important. Rhema, which means the spoken word, and logos, which means the written word. And the Jews actually believed that God spoke to Moses, and he gave him both an oral and a written word. And the written word is in the Bible, and the oral word, well, they made that up, basically. But we'll talk about that more next time. And there's two types of eschatology. One is called personal eschatology. Now, I was going to say that we've never really covered that subject. But last week, Graham did. He must have read my mind. And he covered it. It's talking about end things in relationship to life. What happens at the end of your life and all that sort of thing. What happens at the end of Satan's time. Where's he going to and all this sort of stuff. That's all to do with what we call personal eschatology. General eschatology is what we far more often talk about in this church. It relates to things like the rapture, the great tribulation, the second coming. It relates to the millennial kingdom. And it also relates to the New Jerusalem. And during the course of this year, we'll look at all those different subjects. But I want to raise the issue today. Why is it that Israel became such a great nation in the eyes of God? Why is it that Israel seemed to be, in many ways, the most important nation? After all, the Bible mentions Israel over 2,300 times. So what's the future for Israel? In order to know something about the future of Israel, we need to know something about the past and what God promised them. Because God made promises to Israel that he never ever made to any other nation. And that's why they're mentioned over 2,300 times in the Bible. Italy is mentioned 5 times. France isn't mentioned at all. And even Spain's only mentioned once. Britain's also not mentioned. So why is that? Well, in order to understand this question, you have to start with the first person who was really Jewish in the eyes of God, which was a man called Abraham. You probably know him better as Abraham because God changed his name, didn't he? Well, what do we know about Abraham? Well, first thing we know about Abraham from secular sources is written in a book by Josephus. Josephus is probably the greatest Jewish historian ever. He lived from 37 to 100 AD. He was really born round about the time that Saul of Tarsus was converted. Most people put that conversion about 35 to 37 AD. And so he was born around about that time, but he became the greatest historian. This is what he tells us about Abraham. He says he was a man of great wisdom. He was not mistaken in his opinions. That's a pretty powerful thing to say, isn't it? He said that there was one God and he was the creator of the universe. Now, this was not common where he lived in those days. They believed in worshipping the sun and the moon, and they actually thought that the sun and the moon had personality, that they really were gods. So, you know, if the sun had decided one day that he was going to come out and shine, that was up to him. But if he decided to stay indoors like he often does in Britain, well, that was up to him. They regarded the sun as being like a person. They really thought the sun was a god, where he lived in Ur of the Chaldees. But he said, no, that's wrong. He said, God controls the sun and the moon. He created everything. And this made him very unpopular where he lived, which is probably why he was very pleased when God told him that he ought to move. Now, what does the Bible tell us about Abraham? Well, first of all, he tells us that Abraham was God's friend. Let's have a look at a passage that actually says that, the book of Isaiah. Turn to the book of Isaiah. Just a bit after Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah. And chapter 41. Verse 8. But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Hope God considers that I'm his friend. But he called Abraham friend, and so did James. James 2, verse 23, he was called the friend of God. The second thing we learn is that God visibly appeared to Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, which is what the land was called at that time, later on called Babylonia. We're told that in Acts 7, verse 2, that the glory of God appeared to him while in Mesopotamia. That means that he had a visible manifestation of what we call the Shekinah glory. God appeared in some sort of visible form to him at that time and spoke to him. The third thing we learn is that his family served other gods. We're told that in Joshua 24, verse 2. Also, if you go to Genesis 11, verse 24, tells us here who his dad was. And Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. He was the father of Abraham. Terah means moon. So that shows that they were into moon worship. And in fact, if you study into the meaning of some of his relatives, you'll find that they're things to do with the moon. Now, why is it then that he became so great? Because it seems that at this time, he was God's special friend. You remember how God said about Job that there was none like him? Well, it seems that there was none like Abraham at this time. And in verse 1 of chapter 12, it says this. This is the first promise that God ever makes to Abraham. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get ye out of this country and from amongst these people and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and curse them that curse you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. God will eventually develop this, and eventually he gives Abraham three promises. Can you put the second slide up, please, Chris? Thanks very much. He promises him these three things. The first thing he promises him is land. That the land of Canaan will become the land of his relatives, his descendants. The second thing he promises him is seed. Seed that will become like the stars of heaven. They will be so innumerable. Now that is not the case today. There are about 100 people who are Chinese compared to one Jew. There are about 85 people who are Indian compared to one Jew. And there's about 5 people in Britain compared to one Jew. That's more or less the ratio. So that hasn't happened, but it will happen one day. It will actually happen in the millennial kingdom. It has to happen because otherwise God tells lies. And thirdly, spiritual blessings. Now, there's a particular spiritual blessing that is promised in Genesis 22, verse 18. Turn to that passage. Now, there it says, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. That's what he said to him. Now the Hebrew word for this is zerah. The Hebrew word for seed is zerah. It's like our English word sheep. It's the same regardless of whether it's singular or plural. You have one sheep, 100 sheep, 1,000,000 sheep. It stays the same. When zerah is used in the book of Genesis, when it's used in the plural, it's talking about the Hebrew race. When it's used in the singular, it's talking about the Messiah. Genesis 22, verse 18, is talking about the Messiah. He's the special seed who is going to bless all the nations of the earth. Now, as a result of this, you may say, well, yes, but didn't a lot of people came from Abraham? Do you know how many sons Abraham eventually had?
Eight.
He eventually had 8 sons, that's correct. And a lot of these different countries originate from Abraham. But the Abrahamic covenant was only given to two men after it was given to Abraham. One was Isaac, his son Isaac, and one was his grandson Jacob. And only one race upon the earth come from all three of those men, and that is the nation of Israel. That's what originally made them great. Now, eventually, God will give Israel four more covenants. One of those covenants is called the Mosaic Covenant. We're not going to deal with that today because that's not relative to what I'm talking about. But basically, he taught, if Israel obey God, they will be blessed by him. If they disobey, they will be cursed by him. But Israel will never go so far that God will completely turn his back upon them. The worst thing that can happen to Israel is being dispelled from the land. The worst thing that can happen to any other nation is to become extinct. And many of the enemies in past history who rebelled against Israel eventually became extinct. Some years ago, David and I were in Israel, and we actually saw this t-shirt that talked about all these countries, ancient countries, that rebelled against Israel. And it said, extinct, extinct, extinct. It was on this t-shirt that we saw in the shop. And then it said, Iran, question mark, question mark, question mark. And I said to David, we've got to go and have a look at this shop. The guy turned out to be a really interesting guy. He wasn't a Christian, but he knew both Jacob and he knew Arnold as well. And he talked to them. And he actually sold New Testaments and things like that. He found that American and British Christians were some of his best customers. So he sold all these things, despite the fact that he didn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. But he did believe that there was going to be a future temple. He knew about Ezekiel's temple. And we actually found that he knew a lot more about what the Old Testament taught than most of the Christians in our party, didn't we, David? And sometimes he believed a lot more of it as well. So anyway, the first covenant they were given was the land covenant after this. That's in Deuteronomy 29 and Deuteronomy 30. Now basically, the land covenant explores the land aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. And this is what it teaches. In Deuteronomy 29, it teaches that Israel will not obey God, and as a result, they will suffer a dispersion that will eventually lead to them going into 90 different nations of the world. But in Deuteronomy 30, it teaches this at the start of it. Verse 1, and it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before you, he set them in chapters 27 and 28, and you shall call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord God has driven you, and shall return unto the Lord your God, and shall obey his voice according to all that I command you this day, you and your children with all your heart and with all your soul, that then the Lord your God will turn your captivity and have compassion upon you, and will return and gather you from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. Notice that it doesn't say if they do this, it says when they do it. In other words, it's absolutely certain that one day they will do it. Okay. Now, the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7 and 1 Chronicles 17, basically that explores the seed aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. And the thing that it teaches that's most important is that Jesus will ultimately come from the seed of David. You would be a direct descendant from David. And that's why the New Testament starts off by saying that Jesus is of the seed of Abraham and the seed of David, the two qualifications necessary to be the Messiah. The third one is the New Covenant. If we turn to Jeremiah 31, verse 31, this new covenant was actually given when the Shekinah glory had departed from the nation of Israel. You can read about it departing in chapters 8 to 10 of Ezekiel. In chapter 11 of Ezekiel, it also gives the new covenant. This is what it says in verse 31. Behold, the days come, says the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to give them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant they broke, that's the Mosaic covenant, although I was a husband unto them, says the Lord, but this shall be the covenant I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbour, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least unto the greatest of them, says the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. The Bible teaches ultimately there won't even be any need for evangelism in Israel. In the millennial kingdom, all Jews will be saved. If you're wondering how this is possible, it's quite simple. God's got a book up in heaven, which is called the Lamb's Book of Life. And he will just make sure that every time a Jewish baby is born, that they're in that book. If they're not, you'll make sure they're born to a Gentile. It's as simple as that. God really does have the power to do those things. The Bible really does teach that the whole nation of Israel would one day be saved. It doesn't teach that all Jews throughout history will be saved. People like Judas quite obviously weren't saved. After this, there was a captivity. The first captivity started in 733, and that was in the Galilee when Tiglath-Pileser III invaded there. He was the Assyrian ruler at that time. The second one was in Samaria in 721. That's the capital of Israel. Remember, Israel was the northern kingdom at that time. It divided into Israel and Judah. And that happened. That was originally under Shalmaneser IV, but he died and Sargon took over. And they led many people off into Assyria, and they were actually very cruel to the Jews. Judah, they lasted a bit longer because they actually stayed on the right road a bit better than Israel did. But in the end, they went completely straight. And in the end, according to the prophet Ezekiel, they were even worse. And in the days of Ahaz and Manasseh, they actually sacrificed their own sons in the fire to Moloch. Very serious sin. So there were three deportations in 605, that's the one that Daniel was involved in. 597, that was the one where Ezekiel got carried off. And 586 is the one where they destroyed the Jewish temple and they took the king of that time, Zechariah, off. He was actually blinded by them. The following century, a man called Herodotus was born. He was a Greek historian. He was born in 484. And he started calling the Philistines by the name Palestine. Now, this was completely wrong, but that's what he did. The Philistines eventually, in the days of Alexander the Great, you're now talking about something like 330 AD, eventually fled from Alexander the Great and fled into Israel, just as the prophet Zechariah said they would. Many of them even became circumcised, and they eventually became basically Jews. They became nationalized Jews eventually. The nation of Philistia basically died out at that time. Nobody except Herodotus ever used this name until Flavius Josephus came along. And sadly, he used this name and used it about the Jews. Why he did that, I have no idea. Then Hadrian, in 135 AD, started using it on a regular basis about the Jews. Basically, he wanted to destroy the Jews. There were two Jewish wars with the Romans. The first one in 66 to 70 AD, where the temple was destroyed. The second one in 132 to 135. That one was called the Simon Bar Kokhba Revolt because he was declared to be the Messiah. And originally the Christians joined in with that second war. But when he was declared to be the Messiah, they could fight no more. And eventually Rome defeated them. Huge amounts of Jews started to leave the land of Israel. Already many Jews had left in the first century. We know from Peter that he quoted various different places they'd been. The book of Acts talks about different places that the Jews went and established synagogues. So a lot of them left in the first century, but huge amounts more left in the second century. Now you may say to me, well, why is it then that in the 1611 King James Bible, the supposedly infallible version, that the word Palestine is used five times? Well, let's have a look at this issue. If you turn to Ezekiel 16, verse 57. Let's see whether you've got the word Palestine in there. If you've got a 1611 King James Version, you probably will have. Ezekiel 16 and verse 57. Longest chapter in the book of Ezekiel. Before your wickedness was discovered, at the time of your reproach of the daughters of Syria and all that are round about her, the daughters of the Philistines which despise you round about. No, I've got the word Philistines in there. Has anybody got the word Palestine there? It should say Philistia or Philistine. The Hebrew word is Peleshet, and it does not mean Palestine. It means Philistine. The word Palestine should not be in the Bible at all, and anybody who's put it in the Bible has put it in the Bible because they have a flawed Bible theology, basically. They're trying to promote something that is actually incorrect. And so after this, we saw the scattering of Israel, just as Deuteronomy 29 had predicted. And fewer Jews lived in the nation of Israel as they scattered into these 90 different Gentile nations. In 1517, the Ottoman Turks took control of Israel, and they were basically Islamic in their religious faith. And they really destroyed the country because they brought in taxation. And one of the things they said was that every landowner would have to pay a certain amount according to how many trees he had on his land. So guess what the landowners did? They started chopping down all the trees. Don't have to pay any taxes then. And the land became more and more desolate. In 1867, a man called Samuel Clemens came to visit the land of Israel. This man's probably better known by his name, Mark Twain. He said the whole place was a complete and total dump. He said the only place that was worth visiting was Jerusalem. And apparently there were only 10,000 Jews living in the land by then. 8,000 were living in Jerusalem, only 2,000 were living outside of Jerusalem. The whole place was a complete dump. It was a land that wasn't worth living in. In 1881, due to the pogroms in Russia and the Ukraine, Jews started to leave those countries. There were a lot of Jews living in Russia at that time. And they started to leave there. They started to leave the Ukraine as well. They didn't all go back to Israel. Quite a few of them actually went to the USA. And for a very long time, the USA had more Jews living in it than what Israel did. But they did start to go back, and the numbers started to go up in the land of Israel. And obviously, Israel started to become stronger. In 1902, a man called Arthur Balfour became Prime Minister of Britain. For 3 years, he was Prime Minister. He was a very good man. He believed that the Jews should have all the land that was promised to them in the Bible. And so he set about trying to make that a reality. And in 1917, the Balfour Declaration came into play. The British government actually made an announcement that they were going to support a state of Israel, modern state of Israel. And he actually signed an agreement with them. He was the only person who did sign it. He signed it in the British Library. However, just like Brexit, there were people in opposition to this. There's always somebody in opposition, isn't there? Satan's always got somebody to try to derail the programme. In 1924, along with Lord Ravenscroft, he went to Israel and he was promising Israel a future state. Ravenscroft was promising the Arabs a future state. Two British ministers promising two totally different things. The whole thing was supposed to have been sorted out by a man called Tony Eden, but he was told not to allow people outside of Israel to go into that land. He was told to stop any future Arabs who wanted to go into there to go in there. Well, did he? No, he allowed hundreds of thousands of Arabs into the country. In 1929, he was actually questioned about this as to why he had done this, and he said, because I don't like the Jews. Well, at least he was honest. By 1939, Arthur Balfour had died some years previously. He died in 1930. He actually died quite close to here in Woking. And in 1939, they produced another paper called the White Paper. This completely stopped Jewish immigration for nearly a year. No Jews were allowed into Israel for nearly a year. Eventually, it started again. The Arabs were actually in complete disagreement with this white paper, despite the fact that it gave them far more rights than what they were previously entitled to. Even when you give a lot of these Arab nations far more rights, they still don't think that's enough. They want the whole lot. They would never be satisfied with anything less than the whole nation of Israel being driven from the promised land. This led to the creation of Jordan in 1946, where Britain basically were largely responsible for giving 77% of the land to Arab nations. The modern people say, why isn't there a modern state of the Arabs in this promised land? There is. It's called Jordan. They just don't know their history. On the 14th of May 1948, the creation of Israel came about. It had actually been voted in favour of 6 months earlier in the United Nations. 33 countries voted in favour of it, 13 were against it, and 10 abstained. Guess which one Britain was? Maybe the one who abstained, sat on the fence. If you read Isaiah 66, verse 8, it actually talks about a time when something will happen in the day and the nation will be created in a moment of time. And many people believe that that prophecy was fulfilled in 1948 when that happened. Now, there was a man called Al Shrimmer, and he was rather concerned about the Jews at that time. He was actually born to Jewish parents in New York, and he was very concerned about the Jews because he knew that they only had a few aeroplanes. They had 18 aeroplanes, and none of them were modern-day aeroplanes. So he actually smuggled 30 aeroplanes into Israel. After the war, he was actually got into trouble with the Americans for this because he didn't use anybody's authority to do this. He just did it off his own back. And he was actually condemned for doing it, and he was actually told that he couldn't come back to America. But he didn't care by them because he had actually moved to Israel, and the Israelis loved him. And in 1953, he actually became part of this new program, which is called the Israeli Aerospace Business. And it still flourishes today in Israel. It's still part of Israel today, apparently. Eventually, in 2001, Bill Clinton actually pardoned him. I seriously doubt that he cared tuppence. But that's what happened at that time. Israel also only had 35,000 soldiers. Their navy was practically non-existent. The population of Jews by that time in Israel was 650,000. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the 14th of May, David Ben-Gurion announced that a new Jewish state had been created. He was a bit late because most of the Jews by then were out on the streets of Jerusalem running up and down and dancing like mad. They'd all heard about it. Within 4 hours, Egypt had attacked and bombed Tel Aviv. Within days, 4 more countries, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq and Arabia, had joined in the fight. They declared that they were going to drive the Jews into the sea in 2 days. That's what they said they were going to do. And they created the refugee problem. They put it on an Arab broadcast, and the whole load of Arabs actually left the country at that time. And, well, they never came back. The Jews told them not to leave the country. The Jewish government said, stay where you are. We are not going to be defeated in 2 days. It's interesting, they actually believed, although David Ben-Gurion never claimed to be a Christian, he said you have to believe in miracles every day to believe in the modern day survival of the nation of Israel. 2 days, where it lasted 8 months. At one stage, the Arabs were doing so badly, I say Egypt alone ought to have been able to absolutely flatten Israel. Their forces were so much greater, and yet there were 5 different nations. They were doing so badly that they actually asked the Israelis for a ceasefire at one stage, and the Israelis even gave it to them. The Israelis weren't interested in attacking them. They were just interested in defending their own land. The war went on for 8 months, and they lost. The Arab nations were profoundly beaten. It's funny, you know, because the hand of God comes into play every so often. In 1917, when it was decided that there was going to be a new state, the British decided to send a man called Major General Allenby in with the British forces, and they drove the Ottoman Turks out. But the Ottoman Turks thought his name was Allenby, which meant in their language, let it be the will of Allah. And every so often, you see God's hand coming into play, and something really supernatural happening. And this is exactly what happened in later years. In 1956, there was a big war over the Suez Canal, and the French and the British actually helped the Israelis in that war. But in 1967, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan all combined together. They had a force 6 times as big as the Israelis, and they thought they would wipe the Israelis out. But once again, God's hand came into play. Do you remember there's a story in the Bible where Absalom rebels against David, and he goes off and he starts to talk to his advisors, And all David's advisors say, do not enter into a war with Absalom. We'll go out and fight the war for you. You're worth 10,000 of us. And David takes their advice. But David had this friend called Hushai. And he went off and he pretended to Absalom that he had defected to him. Now, Absalom had a man there called Ahithophel. And Ahithophel, it says in the Bible, that his counsel was like the counsel of God. In other words, whatever he says, just do it. Because it's like God's telling you what to do. So he gives him this really good counsel, basically the same as David's men would give him. Don't go into the battle yourself. Hushai says, oh, you must go into the battle. You must fight. He gives him the most stupid advice. And what does Absalom say? Oh, yeah, the advice of Hushai is much better than Ahithophel. Ahithophel goes off and hangs himself. Talk about being a bad loser. But he took his advice, and of course it led to his downfall. Well, in 1967, the Egyptians were equally stupid. They went off for breakfast at 8:30 every morning, and the Israelis were spying on them and noticed this. So they decided to bomb them. They bombed all their artillery. They destroyed 85% of it. The Egyptians also thought that they could destroy Jerusalem. According to Lance Lambert, in a book called Miracle of Israel, when they came over the hill, there was a fog that came down like a man's hand, and they had to call off the attack. Once again, God defends the nation of Israel. God's got a long memory. He remembers what he told Abraham originally. They were stupid and they lost. After 6 days, they lost that war. Unfortunately, this led to a certain amount of Jewish complacency, and they were not ready for what happened in 1973. In 1973, Egypt and Syria made one last attempt to finally defeat Israel. And they decided on what was actually a very good tactic. They decided they would attack on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish war. Now, many, many centuries before this, there was a group of holy people known as the Hasidim, and they would fight, and they were very ferocious fighters. The Bible talks about them as people who did great exploits in the book of Daniel. But their enemies started to find out that they wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. So, of course, their enemy always attacked them on the Sabbath. In the end, the Hasidim decided they had to fight on the Sabbath. So they attacked Israel at Yom Kippur. It took 10 days for them to get the army all back to normal. People had gone all over the place, visiting relatives and everything. 10 days it took them. Israel was virtually defenseless for those 10 days. An Egyptian commander who eventually became a Christian declared that the Egyptians wandered around in the desert when they could have been conquering Jerusalem. And he said to this day, nobody can explain why this happened. The Syrians were asked why they didn't conquer the Galilee. They said there was a huge Israeli force protecting it. According to the Israelis, there was no force at all. Now, once again, who did they really see? Do you remember Gehazi? He was the servant of Elisha. And he said, oh, look, the king of Syria, he's coming to conquer us. And Elisha said, yeah, but we got far more forces than him. He said, open his eyes, Lord. And he opened his eyes, and suddenly Gehazi could see all these angelic forces around. The things that are in the Bible are still happening in modern day. People say, oh, these things never happen now. It's all in the Bible thousands of years ago. Well, sorry, but they do happen now. God is still moving amongst his people. Golda Meir rang Richard Nixon at 3:00 in the morning. She was so desperate. And she said, help us, we are dying. Now, most of his military whips said, don't help them. Henry Kissinger, being the compassionate person that he was, said, let the Jews bleed a little longer. That's what he said. But Richard Nixon, when he was a boy, his mother was a Christian, and she told him Bible stories about Israel. And she said, if you are ever in a position to help Israel, help them. What a thing to ask. Why would she ever think that he was going to be in a position to help Israel? And so he did. In the next 32 days, they poured 5,000 tanks into Israel. More tanks than I think Israel had ever seen. When the British allies fought at Normandy, they had 5,300 tanks also mainly supplied, no doubt, by the United States. And Germany only had 1,500 tanks. So the Israelis had 3 1/3 times as many tanks as what Germany had when they fought their final battle. And from that time on, they started to pull them back, pull them away. From that time on, Israel started to win the war. If you turn to Esther 4, verses 13 and 14, and has this to say. Esther 4, that's the book before Job. 13 and 14. Now Mordecai was cousins with Esther, and this is what he told her. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, who at the time was the queen, "Think not with yourself that you shall escape in the king's house more than all the Jews." Now, a man called Haman had actually made a commandment which would have led to the assassination of all these Jews. Haman was an Agagite. And as you remember, in the days of Saul, Samuel told Saul to go out and destroy all the Agagites, and he didn't. If he'd done what God and Samuel told him to do, Haman would have never been born in the first place. So even when God makes some extraordinary statement like kill everybody amongst all those people, there's a reason for it. God knows the future, we don't. "For if you hold your peace at this time, there shall be enlargement and deliverance shall arise from the Jews from another place." That's what happened. Deliverance arose from another place. It arose from the United States. "But you and your father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether you are come into the kingdom for a time such as this." Now, in the end, Richard Nixon was not a very good president, and most people remember him for Watergate, but he was there for a time such as this, a president who was going to help Israel. I wonder if Obama had been in control at that time, whether he would have made the decision that Richard Nixon made. I seriously doubt it. He was there for that very time. In 1978, Anwar Sadat and David Begin sat down at Camp David and made out a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. To this day, both nations have kept to it. I just want to finish by talking a little bit about two things. One is the partitioning of the land. Because of Britain in 1946, they lost 77% of the land. The Oslo Peace Accord in 1994 led to them losing more of the land. And since then, Gaza has been given away. Partitioning of the land. If you turn to the book of Joel, the prophecies of the book of Joel, it actually talks about this. The book of Joel talks about a great locust invasion that inspires Joel to prophesy what will happen in the Great Tribulation, where there will be another great locust invasion, although on that occasion it will be demonic spirits that sting people like locusts. After that, he goes on to talk about the Lord coming again. Verse 1 of chapter 3. "For behold, in those days and at that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem." The captivity of Judah and Jerusalem will not be complete until Jesus comes again. And then all Jews will come back from wherever they are and will live in the land of Israel. "And I will also gather all nations and will bring them into the valley of Jehoshaphat," which means the Lord judges, "and will plead with them there for the people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land." Do you know that the word for parted there means partition? Over 2,500 years ago, the Bible predicted that in the end times, the Gentile nations would partition the land of Israel. Another thing that's interesting is what Amos says. If you go on to the following book, Amos 9. "And I will bring again the captivity," verse 14, sorry, "of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. and I will plant them upon the land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of the land which I have given them, says the Lord thy God. Now, the ultimate fulfillment of that will come in the millennial kingdom. The fact is that God is bringing the nation of Israel back into Israel. Today, it is believed that there are 6.8 million Jews now living in Israel. There are more Jews now in Israel than what there are in the United States. There's only about 5.5 million in the United States now. So it's now the predominant nation amongst the Jews. Israel are unbeatable. Israel cannot be beaten. And God chose Israel to show who the real God was. Jesus described God the Father as the one true God. In Psalm 83, it tells you about what would happen in the end days with Israel and the nations. Psalm 83. It's our final reference we'll look at today. And this is what it says. Verse 2. For lo, your enemies make tumult, and they that hate you, that's Israel, have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against my people and consulted against their hidden ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. Do you know that Gamal Nasser, who was the president of Egypt in 1967, actually said that at the start of the 1967 war? Those were the precise words that he used to describe it. Now, if you go on further to verse 15. So persecute them with your tempest and make them afraid with your storm. This is what David's saying to God. Fill their faces with shame. In other words, make them embarrassed. That they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and troubled forever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish. David has some strong prayers to say. That men may know that you, whose name alone is Yahweh, it literally says in Hebrew, are the most high over all the earth. All these different nations against Israel do not know that Yahweh is the most high God in all the earth. They think that Allah is. We are to actually pray that Israel will win because it is a testimony to the fact that Yahweh is the true God and Allah is a false God. So we should be praying for Israel to win every time we hear of the war. And we should be praying that these Muslims recognize what this means. Because Muslims believe that if their God beats your God, that means their God's greater than your God. That's an ancient belief. And that's what they believe. And a man called Mark Gabriel actually became a Christian. And one of the reasons why he was asked why he became a Christian, because he was a Muslim, he said, I came to the conclusion that the Jews worshipped the real God because they kept on beating all the Arab nations in every war they fought against them. So that's the conclusion he came to. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem is what the Bible says, isn't it? And one day Jesus is going to come and Jerusalem will be at peace, the city of peace that it's supposed to be. Next time we'll look at the future of Israel and what's going to happen to them in the future.